So what's a funded pension? Well, a funded pension is one in which your pension is drawn completely from the realization of returns on the investments of contributions into a pension fund that typically both you and your employer have made contributions into during your working life. Now, this fund might be held by just you as an individual, as in the case of traditional individual defined contribution pension pots or 401k arrangements, which I discussed last week, or the fund might be held collectively with others with whom one pools risks. Now, the funded occupational defined benefit pension scheme, which was the topic of my first lecture, and collective defined contribution CDC, which was the topic of my second lecture, each involve collective funding. Now, investment risk poses perhaps the greatest challenge for funded pensions. So especially in recent years with government bond yields as low as they are, the low risk option of investment in long dated inflation linked government bonds that match the pensions liabilities has become extremely expensive. In order, however, to reap the premium of higher expected returns on equity and property, one must contend with the risk that these returns will fall far short of expectation. In the last two lectures, I considered a number of different ways in which individuals and collectives might try to manage these risks. Now, needless to say, none of these ways provides a foolproof method of dealing with the uncertainty of returns on investment in equities and property. Now, in light of the problems to which investment risk gives rise, I think it would be worthwhile to consider the merits and promise of another form of pension provision, which doesn't involve the investment of contributions which have been deposited into a pension fund. Now, since you say DC and I say DB and others say CDC, no CIDC perhaps, we should call the whole funded pension thing off. And that's why in today's lecture, I shall consider the case for pensions that are provided on an unfunded pay-as-you-go basis. Now, with a pay-as-you-go pension scheme, money is transferred from those who are currently working to pay the pensions of those who are currently retired. Like many other state pensions, those in the US and the UK are pay-as-you-go. So rather than drawing from a pension fund consisting of a portfolio of financial assets, US and UK state pensions are paid out of annual tax revenues. Now, the pension one is entitled to in retirement is, however, based on, even though not funded by, the contributions one has made during one's working life in the form of a payroll tax. Now, in some countries, neither eligibility for the basic pay-as-you-go state pension nor its level is conditional on contributions of portions of one's earnings during one's working life. Now, these arrangements are more akin to other forms of welfare spending involving redistributive transfers funded solely by general taxation. Now, there remains a non-contributory residency requirement for eligibility, as in the case of other forms of welfare spending. In some cases, there's merely a threshold residency requirement. All who've lived for a given number of years are eligible to the same degree. Now in the Netherlands, the residency requirement is scalar rather than a threshold. So the level of the basic state pension to which one's entitled increases on the basis of the number of years that one has been a resident in the Netherlands. Now, many public sector occupational pensions are also pay-as-you-go. So in the United Kingdom, the pensions of NHS workers, civil servants, and members of the armed forces are on an unfunded pay-as-you-go basis. Now, the teacher's pension scheme in this country is another example, and it's of special relevance as a benchmark of comparison with USS, because alongside teachers in primary and secondary schools, teachers in most of the universities that have been established since 1992 are also members of this pay-as-you-go teacher's pension scheme. Now, in the case of these public sector schemes, there are employee and employer contributions, roughly, you know, so in that respect, similar to private occupational DB schemes, but unlike funded schemes, the contributions go straight into the coffers of the Treasury rather than being invested as a portfolio of assets in a fund. And then pension payments also come from the Treasury's coffers. Now, the case for unfunded pay-as-you-go, as opposed to funded pensions, is, I think, strong when there are compelling grounds to redistribute income from those who have the good fortune to be high earners to those who suffer the misfortune of low earnings, where such redistribution cannot be achieved by means of the risk pooling of the earnings of different people. That's in the actual ex ante self-interest of all who enter the pool. So in other words, unfunded pay-as-you-go is justified when we require the services of Robin Hood and not just the insurance of a mutual association. Now, like a number of other unfunded pay-as-you-go state pensions, the UK state pension is in fact highly redistributive from higher to lower earners. The amount that one contributes is proportional to one's income up to an income ceiling, but the amount of one's annual pension in retirement is proportional in the UK simply to the number of years one has worked and made mandatory contributions on income that exceeds a very low amount. And therefore, money is transferred from high earners to low earners with the goal of relieving poverty in old age on what has come to be known as the Beveridge as opposed to the Bismarck approach to state pensions. Now, this sort of arrangement, highly redistributive, would probably not be in the actual ex ante self-interest of each to adopt at the point at which one leaves full-time education and begins one's working career. And this is because even at the early point of entering the workforce, each person probably has a fairly good idea of whether his expected earnings will be high or low. It would probably or maybe not be in the rational self-interest of those who expect to be high earners to choose a state pension along UK lines. I think one may need to impose a thicker hypothetical veil, which deprives people of knowledge of their talents and therefore their earning potential in order to render in the rational self-interest of each to choose such a redistributive state pension at the beginning of his adult life. Now, a Dworkinian luck egalitarian would offer just such a justification based on hypothetical insurance choices for an unfunded redistributive pay-as-you-go state pension. But what I want to do is consider the question of whether there's a reciprocity based for an unfunded pay-as-you-go pension, such as the American or the UK state pension. In particular, might such an argument provide a realization of reciprocity in the Rawlsian sense of fair terms of social cooperation for mutual advantage, which Rawls situates as follows in the quotation on the screen: between altruistic impartiality and mere mutual advantage. Rawls says, in political liberalism, the idea of reciprocity lies between the idea of impartiality, which is altruistic, being moved by the general good, and the idea of mutual advantage, understood as everyone's being advantaged with respect to each person's present or expected future situation as things are. He says, as understood in his theory of justice, reciprocity is a relation between citizens expressed by principles of justice that regulate a social world in which everyone benefits, judged with respect to an appropriate benchmark of equality defined with respect to that world. Now, the fact that people would prudently select a redistributive pay-as-you-go state pension from behind Rawls's hypothetical veil of ignorance is, I think, insufficient to establish that it embodies this idea of reciprocity. Now, there are, I think, the following reasons why it's hard to interpret Rawlsian self-interested choice behind the veil of ignorance as involving reciprocity. Now, first, it doesn't involve an agreement or even tit-for-tat interaction between different individuals. It rather involves a self-interested choice of a single individual. It's a point that Gene Hampton made decades ago. And second, the choice is self-interested only on the hypothetical assumption that the individual might turn out to be any member of society. Now, just to briefly elaborate on the second point, since it's a fairly, the choice is not in everyone's actual self-interest. Moreover, it's in everyone's ex-ante self-interest only by virtue of the imposition of a veil that renders one ignorant of one's fate. Now, the normative appeal of the claim that the chosen option is to the advantage of each is undermined if we can provide such a justification only on the assumption that nobody knows who he is. Now, Rawls maintains that his original position models a fair system of cooperation for mutual advantage between free and equal persons, but on account of the impartiality of the choice that the veil ensures among symmetrically situated individuals, what would be chosen behind the veil might constitute a fair system of cooperation among equals, but it might not be the mutual advantage, be to the mutual advantage of the parties. Now, it's a point that Brian Berry made a while ago. Such choice behind the veil might be better understood as modeling impartial altruism than reciprocity. So we shouldn't be misled by Rawls's modeling involving self-interested choice into thinking that the terms of cooperation chosen in his original position are to the mutual advantage of each. So let's see if we can provide an account of the reciprocity of a pay-as-you-go pension scheme, which doesn't require this hypothetical imposition of a Rawlsian veil, in order to see whether we can demonstrate the mutually advantageous nature of the scheme without the veil. Well, worker contributions that pay for the pensions of those in retirement in an unfunded pay-as-you-go scheme are not in return for benefits that those in retirement confer on this group of workers. And therefore, what's going on in the pay-as-you-go pension scheme differs from the typical bi-directional form of reciprocity in which parties exchange benefits with one another. One might, however, try to draw an analogy between pay-as-you-go and other intergenerational arrangements, where these other intergenerational arrangements are plausibly characterized as reciprocal, even though they're unidirectional in nature, rather than involving this bi-directional exchange between parties. Now, Rawls's so-called just saving principle might actually provide a nice illustration. Now, I won't go into the details of its principle, but among the requirements of Rawls's just savings principle are that each generation should save for the next at least as much as the previous generation saved for it. Now, Rawls maintains that since generations are spread out in time and actual economic benefits flow in only one direction, there's no way for later generations to help for later generations to help the situation of the least fortunate earlier generation when these generations are non-overlapping. So each generation therefore benefits the next generation by saving for it, but not in exchange for any benefit that the next generation confers on it. Now, in spite of its unidirectional nature, just flowing in one direction into the future, a case can be made that Rawls's just savings principle is in fact grounded in a principle of reciprocity involving the notion of fair return, where the fair return is now to a party other than the party from which one has received a benefit. Rather, any given generation is obliged to benefit the next generation in return for benefits it's received from the previous generation. Now, a just savings principle might be conceived as a form of cooperation insofar as it is to the mutual advantage of each. So along these lines, Rawls writes, if all parties are to gain, except perhaps the earlier ones, the parties must agree to a savings principle that ensures that each generation receives its due from its predecessor and does its fair share for those to come. Now, perhaps the charge of free riding off of the efforts of others can be invoked to condemn those who benefit from the savings of their ancestors without in turn passing on comparable savings to their descendants. Now, though this would not involve an appeal to reciprocity in the ordinary sense involving bidirectional exchanges, it might be thought to involve a version of reciprocity more widely understood. Now, in a manner analogous to that of an unfunded pay-as-you-go pension scheme, but at the level of individual members of a family across overlapping generations, Ken Binmore has argued that conformity to a norm of benefiting one's elders might be a mutually advantageous Nash equilibrium, which is to say an equilibrium in which each does better for himself by conforming rather than defecting, given the choices of others. So this is Ken Binmore's case. It involves what we might think of as a slight extension of my Robinson Crusoe case from last week, where there's just a single individual on this desert island. Now we have more than one individual. He says, imagine a world in which only a mother and a daughter are alive at any time. Each player lives for two periods. The first period is her youth, and the second is her old age. In her youth, the player bakes two large loaves of bread. She then gives birth to a daughter and immediately grows old. Old players are too feeble to work and so produce nothing. One equilibrium requires each player to consume both her loaves of bread in her youth. Everyone will then have to endure a miserable old age, but in this case, everyone will be optimized given the choices of others. Well, all players would prefer to consume one loaf in their youth and one loaf in old age to spread out their consumption into old age. But this fair outcome can only be achieved if the daughters all give one of their loaves to their mothers, because bread perishes if not consumed when baked. So a world in which each conforms to a norm of sharing with one's elder is better for each than a world in which nobody conforms, but rather each person hoards benefits for herself rather than giving anything to anyone else. Now, Binmore then goes on to offer the following explanation of how conformity to a norm of sharing might emerge. Well, he says, he knows mothers can't retaliate if their daughter is selfish, but the fair outcome could nevertheless be sustained as an equilibrium. So in this fair equilibrium, a conformist is a player who gives her mother a loaf if and only, if this is the norm, give your mother a loaf if and only if her mother was a conformist in her youth. So conformists therefore reward other conformists and punish non-conformists. So to see why a daughter gives her mother a loaf, suppose that Alice, Beatrice, and Carol are mother, daughter, and granddaughter. If Beatrice neglects Alice, then she becomes a nonconformist, and Carol therefore punishes Beatrice to avoid becoming a nonconformist herself. If not, she'll be punished by her daughter, and so on. If, Binmore says, the firstborn player is deemed to be a conformist, is therefore a perfect equilibrium for everyone to be a conformist. Everyone is better off than they could otherwise be given the choices of others. Now, Joseph Heath has employed a similar model to try to show that unfunded pay-as-you-go pension schemes embody a form of indirect reciprocity involving intergenerational cooperation where benefits flow in one direction only. So workers of one generation pay for the pensions of those in retirement at that time in return for having their pensions paid by the next generation of workers when they retire. Now, Heath describes a motivation to contribute to pay-as-you-go university pension in the following terms. He says, every month, a fairly large portion of my salary is deducted from my paycheck and essentially handed over to one of my emeritus colleagues. At the end of the year, I'm sent a letter telling me what my own anticipated monthly pension will be based on my current salary and accumulated years of service. But he says this is nothing more than a promise and a weak one at that. It's hostage to all the vicissitudes of employee-employer bargaining over the next 20 years. So then he asks this question, so why do I agree to this? And his answer is as follows. He says, it's because I'm confident that when I'm older and retired, there will be a new generation of young professors who are willing to do the same thing for me that I'm currently doing for my emeritus colleagues. So then he asks, but why should I willing to hand over 5% of their salary to me? It was written a while ago and employee contributions weren't as high as they are now. He says, certainly, why should I expect the next generation to be willing to hand over 5% of their salary to me? Certainly not out of gratitude for the fact that I'm doing so now to the benefit of my older colleagues. Rather, it's because I expect them to expect that they will someday have younger colleagues who will do the same for them. That is, that the chain of cooperation will continue on into the future unbroken, or that the pension scheme will remain, as they say, a going concern. Now, unlike Binmore's case, in which one's contribution is directed towards a single individual to whom one has special ties, one's mother, workers' pensions contributions are anonymously spread out among a group of strangers. So the choice of individuals to make contributions to a large anonymous scheme can't readily be explained as a socially enforced norm that gives rise to a Nash equilibrium. Rather, there's a need for enforcement mechanisms, which ultimately involve the threat of state-imposed penalties. Now, in the case of employer-based pay-as-you-go pensions, members don't actually voluntarily pay pensions contributions into the employer scheme on the other understanding that if they do, then the next generations of workers will voluntarily pay into the pension scheme as well, in accordance with a norm of conformity, which is a Nash equilibrium. Rather, what underpins such a pension scheme is rather a standard, bilateral, reciprocal, and legally enforceable contract between the members of a given generation and the institution that promises them a pension in return for their contribution, where this institution is the state, in the case of a public sector pension scheme. Now, a pay-as-you-go defined benefit private occupational pension would also involve a promise by the employer. Moreover, employer-based pay-as-you-go pensions could not be sustained in the absence of such an enforceable promise that the employer extends to workers. Now, in the case of a state pay-as-you-go pension, contributions are explained by the fact that the state makes them mandatory in a manner that's backed up by threat of punishment. The state could not rely on individuals voluntarily making contributions in accordance with a norm that gives rise to a Nash equilibrium any more than they could rely on the voluntary payment of other taxes. So if a voluntary norm in Nash equilibrium, along the lines of what Binmore sketched, plays any role in explaining how state pensions are sustained over time, I think it will need to be at the level of the collective, of the demos, the electorate, rather than at the level of individuals. State pensions contributions are mandatory, but states tend to provide themselves with a fair amount of discretion in the pensions they end up paying people in retirement. So unlike a contract between employer and employee for an occupational pension, the state pension is not in fact underpinned by a bilateral reciprocal contract that's legally enforceable between the state and the individual, in which the state promises each individual a given level of pension in exchange for his contributions. Rather, the state pension can and has been altered at democratic will. The fact, however, that states continue to voluntarily pay pensions might be explained by the following Nash equilibrium at the level of the collective. Voters democratically choose to continue to make contributions to pay for the pensions of those in retirement, not just because the elderly vote in disproportionate numbers, but because workers realize that if they vote to stop making contributions towards the pensions of those in retirement, stop paying their national insurance contributions, then the next generations of workers will vote against making contributions towards their retirement. Now, assuming that the members of the different generations are equally situated, this mutually advantageous Nash equilibrium might be described as an instance of the type of Rawlsian reciprocity that I introduced earlier, one in which a relation between citizens is expressed by principles of justice that regulate a social world in which everyone benefits judged with respect to an appropriate benchmark of equality, re-quoting from Rawls earlier. But as we shall see in a moment, however, the assumption that the members of the different generations are equally situated is unsound. The first generation is in fact privileged over others, and hence we don't actually have this requisite benchmark of equality among all the generations. So here's the unfairness of the first generation. In actual fact, at least in the United States and the United Kingdom, unfunded pay-as-you-go state pensions involve the prima facie unfairness of the first generation getting a free ride, since they made few, if any, contributions into the system. So the first American, for example, to receive a monthly Social Security check had paid only $24.75 in contributions over 3 years before she received her first monthly check of actually $22.54. Now, after her second check, she had already received more than she had contributed, and she ultimately reached her 100th birthday and collected a total of $22,888.92. Now, here's a theoretical possibility. I guess interesting theoretically, at least. In theory, we could construct an almost entirely unfunded pay-as-you-go state pension scheme in which the first generation to receive a pension in retirement makes contributions into the scheme throughout their working lives. But unlike a normal pay-as-you-go scheme, these contributions don't go towards any pension and payment at the time, since by hypothesis, there are none, this first generation to contribute to pay-as-you-go pension. But now suppose that these contributions were instead invested, ring-fenced, held in reserve for the payment of, suppose that the first generation's contributions are instead invested, ring-fenced, and held in reserve for the payment of their own future pensions, and the same arrangement was applied to all subsequent generations. Well, in that case, we would have just have transformed the arrangement into a funded pension scheme. But now suppose a different possibility. Suppose that the pensions contributions of the first generation were instead invested, ring-fenced, and held in reserve to pay the pension for retirement of the final generation of contributors during their working lives in the event of eventual scheme closure. Now, in this case, all generations will be equally situated insofar as each generation which receives a pension would also make contributions that pay for the pensions of another generation. And hence, each generation would pay the pensions of the previous generation in typically unfunded pay-as-you-go fashion, except for the first generation, whose contributions would loop forward to the final generation. And that, by the way, explains the photograph on the title page. There's a looping forward that's supposed to be represented by that photograph. Now, apart from the fact that the first generation's contributions would be held and invested in a fund for the last generation, this would actually be an unfunded pay-as-you-go realization of an indirect form of Rawlsian reciprocity. Now, reciprocity obtains since each generation both contributes to another generation's pension and receives contributions for its own pensions from another generation. Now, this looping arrangement would incidentally also provide a solution to the problem of backward induction that's been pressed against pay-as-you-go schemes where it's known that they'll eventually close. If you know that it's going to eventually close, or if you know when it's going to close, then you're going to stop contributing into it because you know that there will be no one in the future to contribute for you, but then the next generation before that will stop contributing and so forth. So it zips back to the beginning. It's a problem that Gustav Arrhenius has raised against the pay-as-you-go scheme. And this provides a solution to that problem. It is, however, a merely interesting theoretical possibility, I think. No actually existing pay-as-you-go scheme has ever involved such a looping forward arrangement where the first generation of contributors' contributions are ring-fenced and invested for eventual scheme closure generations and to the future, nor, I think, is it likely at all that such a scheme will be implemented in the future. But this merely theoretically interesting possibility does, however, set the stage for the consideration of another version of pay-as-you-go, which I think realizes reciprocity insofar as each generation both fully contributes to and receives from an ongoing pension scheme. Now, this particular pay-as-you-go arrangement, which I would now like to turn to, involves the notional funding of all pensions promises, including those of the first generation of pensioners. In fact, this isn't merely an interesting theoretical possibility. It actually has been realized in practice and fully funded pay-as-you-go. And since I think it has many virtues, and I'd like to consider the case for it, what I'm going to do for the remainder of today's lecture is consider the case for a notionally funded pay-as-you-go scheme. And here's how a notionally funded pay-as-you-go scheme works. As in the case of funded defined benefit pension schemes, which I discussed in week one, workers and employers put in pensions contributions each year in return for which they're promised a pension in retirement. The pensions of every member of this pay-as-you-go scheme, including those of the very first generation, are moreover directly proportional to the level of their contributions throughout their working lives. Therefore, the first generation of pensioners does not ride free on the contributions of younger workers. And so the complaint I raised against pay-as-you-go state pensions a few moments ago doesn't apply. Now, United Kingdom public sector pay-as-you-go pension schemes provide a good example of how such notional funding works in practice. The cost of the pensions that public sector workers in this country are promised is covered by the contributions of employers and members and them, plus an assumed rate of return on these contributions. Now, this assumed rate of return also serves as the rate at which the pension's liabilities are discounted. It serves as the discount rate. Now, as in the case of a genuinely funded defined benefit pension, the higher this assumed rate of return, the lower the contributions required for a pension of a given level. Now here, however, the funding is merely notional. It's not actual, since contributions are not placed into a fund which is genuinely invested in assets, rather the contributions go into the coffers of the UK Treasury. Well, question, how is this notional rate of return set? Well, it's set not as the expected rate of return R on the capital of a hypothetical portfolio of financial assets, not even a hypothetical portfolio, let alone an actual portfolio, but rather R is set as the expected long, sorry, the discount rate is set as the expected long-term rate of growth G of the economy, or the expected long-term gross domestic product, growth rate of GDP. Now, what's the rationale for setting the discount rate as G? Well, the rationale is that pay-as-you-go pensions are funded by tax revenues, which grow roughly in line with the growth in the economy. And hence the hypothetical assets of the scheme are metaphorically conceived as claims on future tax revenues. So as the Treasury has explained, the government is not persuaded that a rate consistent with the private sector and other funded schemes would be an appropriate choice as the discount rate used to set unfunded pension scheme contributions. That discount rate reflects the cost inherent in a scheme backed by a portfolio of assets, traded bonds and equities, which aren't held by the unfunded public service schemes where the assets are claims on future tax revenues, unquote. Now, in setting the rate of return on pensions contributions as the rate at which tax revenues are expected to grow, the Treasury maintained that they thereby take into account the costs that's passed to future taxpayers on a fair and sustainable basis. That seems like a plausible claim. Now, there are some efficiency-based grounds, or there would be some efficiency-based grounds for preferring a pay-as-you-go to a genuinely funded pension scheme, such as the low cost of administration, in contrast to the relatively high cost of good management of the asset portfolios of a funded pension scheme, and a notionally funded pay-as-you-go pension scheme might be especially forthcoming when G is greater than R, where G represents the rate of per capita, not merely aggregate growth, of the economy. In that case, it should be possible to provide better pensions for all by means of a notionally funded pay-as-you-go scheme in which pensions are paid out of tax revenues that increase at the rate of G, as compared with a genuinely funded scheme whose assets grow at this assumed lower rate of return on capital R. But such a notionally funded pay-as-you-go pension scheme could be justified as to the reciprocal mutual advantage of each in comparison with a genuinely funded scheme. Now, if Thomas Piketty is right, however, that it was an aberration that G was greater than R during the 20th century, and that R is greater than G for substantial, and that R is greater than G as the historical norm throughout most of history, well, that would undermine this efficiency-based case for pay-as-you-go overfunded provision of pensions promises, at least during the next several decades. If R is greater than G, it undermines but doesn't defeat the case for pay-as-you-go, since, as I hope now to show, case can be made for pay-as-you-go even when R is greater than G, which is to say even when the rate of return on capital exceeds the rate of growth of the economy. To make this case, what I'd like to do is begin by drawing attention to some, I think, striking parallels between a notionally funded pay-as-you-go defined benefit scheme and a genuinely funded one, where these parallels shed light on what a notionally funded pay-as-you-go pension actually consists of and when the case for it will be compelling. Now, as I mentioned in my first lecture, some people maintain that defined benefit schemes should purchase and hold long-dated inflation index-linked government bonds so that the assets of the fund match the liabilities of the pensions promises. Now, I made the case for a less expensive funding by means of growth assets, but I'm going to make a different point now. I'm not going to revisit the case for funding DB by growth assets. The different point I want to make now is that pensions contributions for a notionally funded pay-as-you-go scheme actually constitute the purchase of government bonds. And here's why. So think about what's going on in the notionally funded pay-as-you-go scheme, such as the teachers' pension scheme. In exchange for employer and member pensions contributions that go into the Treasury's coffers, the government makes promises to teachers to pay pensions. Such promises amount to illiquid, non-tradable government annuity bonds. Now, what's the yield on these bonds? Well, the yield of these annuity bonds is the discount rate, which is G, which is a rate of return on these contributions set to the long-term growth in the rate of the economy. Now, the long-term rate of growth in the economy, as currently forecast by the UK government, is CPI plus 2.4%. That's the discount rate of the public sector pension schemes. Now, such annuity bonds have quite an attractive yield relative to the long-dated inflation index bonds that the government issues, where long-dated inflation index bonds have returns of about 2% below CPI at the moment. Now, if such annuity bonds that are issued to the teachers' pension scheme and the like were publicly tradable, funded defined benefit pension schemes alone would create enormous demand for them. And therefore, pay-as-you-go public sector schemes such as the teachers' pension scheme are in effect government bond-funded schemes, but with a much better yield of CPI plus 2.4% than the long-dated index-linked bonds, which some financial economists maintain should largely constitute the portfolios of privately funded defined benefit pensions. Now, a yield of CPI plus 2.4% is not as high as expected long-term return on equities, which is now in the vicinity of CPI plus 4%. But unlike in the case of equities investment, there's no risk to the asset holder. The employers and members who pay the contributions in exchange for the government-issued annuities don't bear any investment risk. Well, should a pension scheme prefer to invest more cheaply in risky equities with a higher expected return, or in the government annuity that has a rate of return pegged to the forecast growth of the economy? Well, perhaps rather than expose themselves to the downside risks of equities, I'm sure that many would leap at the chance to purchase liability matching assets with a government guaranteed return of CPI plus 2.4%, rather than, you know, index-linked bonds of CPI minus 2%. Well, issues of fairness might therefore be thought to arise on account of the fact that the government is issuing and exclusively selling annuity bonds at well below their market value to only some workers and employers, namely those who qualify for membership in public sector pay-as-you-go schemes. So what grounds, for example, are there for the government to make these bonds available for purchase by the new UK universities of the so-called post-92 sector, who enjoy membership in the teachers' pension scheme, while refusing to sell such annuity bonds to the older universities and colleges, which are members of USS? And why, for that matter, does the UK government make these annuity bonds available to Eton College, which is also a member of the teachers' pension scheme, but not to any of the universities in the UK founded before 1992? Now, to overcome such invidiousness and unfairness, why not make these annuity bonds available to all employers and workers in the private sector? Now, here's a related question I would now like to pose to those who call for private sector defined benefit pensions to be funded out of a portfolio of long-dated inflation index-linked government bonds. Question: what explains your preference for funding such pensions at the lower discount rate of index-linked government bonds, rather than the higher discount rate of the annuity bonds that governments make available to public sector schemes? Is it because the yield, so you claim, on long-dated index-linked bonds is set by the free market, whereas the CPI plus 2.4% yield of annuity bonds is the product of an unfree market, given restrictions on who can purchase them and the inability to trade them? Well, but of course, the yield on long-dated index-linked bonds is not determined by a free market, given how outsized a player the government is in this market under quantitative easing. Bond yields are as low as they are on account of the central bank's injection of money into the economy through quantitative easing, involving the buying back of government bonds held by insurance companies, pension funds, banks, and other institutions. And moreover, quantitative easing is a public policy choice. The purpose is to stimulate demand, but demand could be more effectively stimulated through the more widespread issuing and selling not just to public sector employees and workers, but to workers more generally, of the sort of annuity bonds that the government now sells to those in the public sector. And widespread selling of the sorts of annuity bonds that are reserved for the public sector would stimulate consumer demand on account of pensioners having more money to spend. And greater demand would also arise from firms having more money to invest or otherwise spend on things other than pensions contributions, such as the salaries of their workers. And it's ultimately a matter of choice on the part of the government what sorts of bonds to issue and to whom. Now, of course, doing what I've suggested, issuing these annuity bonds across the economy and not just to the public sector, might have undesirable effects that would tell against doing so. I mean, it might give rise to too much inflation or the crowding out of government borrowing from investment in infrastructure and the like, but it's still a matter of government policy choice and should be analyzed along these lines. The government can choose to issue CPI plus 2.4% annuities in greater volume and make them more widely available to workers and employers. There's nothing sort of magical about the current yield CPI minus 2% of index-linked government bonds. So what I want to do now is step back and restate the case I've been developing for collective pensions in this lecture and the previous two. Now, in my last lecture, I showed how CDC converges on defined benefit. I've now just shown how notionally funded pay-as-you-go public sector defined benefit also converges on funded defined benefit. So, climbing the mountain from different sides, all of these approaches converge on a similar form of collective pensions provision, which breaks open the silos of individual defined contribution pension pots and avoids the exorbitant expense of funding that's pegged to long-dated index-linked government bonds. Now, whether it ultimately takes the form of CDC, a genuinely funded defined benefit scheme, or a notionally funded pay-as-you-go defined benefit scheme, we've converged on a collective, multi-generational, society-wide form of pensions provision. So what I want to do now is wrap up by posing the following question. Why should those of you who are young, able-bodied, and productive pay for the pensions of those who are elderly, infirm, and out of work? Should you do so out of a duty to redistribute your known fortune to others who are known to be unfortunate in order to eliminate the unfairnesses of life? If this is the answer to the question I've just posed, then we'll have to rely on the capacity of the fortunate to identify with the fates of badly off strangers and altruistically agree to open their wallets to these strangers. And if the fortunate will not agree, then we'll need to find a Robin Hood who will rob from the rich against their wills to give to the poor, or the state will have to do that. But I think that we can, for the most part, conceive of the case for pensions differently as a form of reciprocity involving cooperation between persons, which is to the antecedent mutual advantage of each in terms of their prospects. We can conceive of the transfer of wealth of pension schemes not as a transfer between different people, but rather as transfers within the possible future lives of each individual, as transfers from one's more fortunate possible future selves to one's less fortunate possible future selves. Now, this case can be addressed to many of you in this virtual Zoom webinar who are university students who have recently reached the age of majority and are near the beginning of your adult lives. Many of you are young, able-bodied, and productive, but barring miraculous breakthroughs in medical technology or discovery of a fountain of youth, you will not remain young and able-bodied forever. Some of you will tragically become seriously incapacitated during your working years as a result of illness or accident. For a few, the illnesses or accidents you suffer will be so serious that you won't survive into old age. But the great majority of you will make it into old age and reach a point when you're no longer willing or able to continue working. But you don't know how long you're going to live in retirement, at least at the beginning of your working lives, nor at that early stage do you know how well any investment that you might try to save up during the next decades for your retirement will fare. Now, from the perspective of the beginning of your working lives, it's therefore rational for each of you to enter into an agreement with others who also don't yet know their fates, that if you turn out to be among the unfortunate whose pensions pots would not have yielded enough for your retirement, resources will be transferred to you from those whose pensions pots would have overflowed in their retirement. But this arrangement will work only if we all agree to bind ourselves in advance so that if we turn out to be among the fortunate, we're not allowed to defect from the scheme and go it alone. So by joining together as a collective in the manner famously depicted on the frontispiece of Hobbes's Leviathan, it's possible to tame the risks that we face as individuals, each with our own private pension pot. Investment and longevity risk can be pooled through the insurance of a mutual association in a manner which is to the ex-ante advantage of each. It's rational for each of us to agree to share one another's fates by pooling risks across both space and time on fair terms of social cooperation for mutual advantage. Thank you all very much.